Welcome back, everyone. This is Watchan Lake Bible School 2012. Our speaker is Brother Stephen Hornhart. His overall title is Come and See, Witnessing for Christ. And this is his third class. His title is, And There Was a Great Earthquake, The Prayers of the Saints Answered, Seal 6. Brother Stephen.
Well, thank you, Brother Ken, and good morning, my beloved brothers and sisters in our Lord Jesus Christ. It's very nice to be with you once again. As we commence our third study, as Brother Ken has said, under the particular topic this morning, God answers the prayers of the saints, and lo, there was a great earthquake. Now, of course, this is the first of the two sessions that we really need to have had much coffee during the coffee break. So we do hope you're reasonably refreshed, looking out at the audience. Actually, you're quite a surprise, actually, by the look of that you have on your face, that you do look quite refreshed after those last couple of sessions that you've had. Now, the reason we need to be a little refreshed is that we're going to go into a very, very challenging chapter, which is chapter 12. Many of us would be aware of it, some not, that when you look at the last six verses of Revelation 6, which of course is the sixth seal, we're given scant detail. Much more detail, of course, will then come when we look at Revelation 12. So we need to look at Revelation 6, the last six verses, and to get the detail of the sixth seal, we need to couple that with Revelation 12. That, of course, poses a question. Why is it that you have to jump several chapters in the Apocalypse to get detail which could have been mentioned in the six verses in chapter 6? Well, more about that in a moment. Now, of course, with chapter 12, brothers and sisters, as an introduction, one of the centrepieces of chapter 12 is the great red dragon. And as we've already alluded, even though that becomes one of the centrepieces, it doesn't remain one centrepiece, because that great red dragon does in fact morph into a different dragon. And so therefore, instead of one, we have two dragons finding their place in chapter 12. Now we need to find out why the dragon changes, when the dragon changes in this chapter. Not only is there a centrepiece of the great red dragon, but also there is another centrepiece, which is a woman. And to add complexity to the chapter, we don't only have one woman, but the woman splits in chapter 12, and we end up with two. One runs away from another woman. So a woman is here, another woman runs away from her. And to add to the complexity, the one that runs away is made up of two women. So we have two dragons, and we have three women. And as we've already alluded to also, is that to add further challenge to chapter 12, we don't have a chronological flow of ideas. There are verses in chapter 12 that take us into the future and then take us back and then zoom us back into a few years ahead and then back again. So it really is going to be a challenge for us, brothers and sisters. Well, thus far, we have looked in our two studies before the white horse that came on the scene, and there was the 84-year window whereby the bow benders would emerge and they would bend their tongues and send out those arrows of the word of the covenant. And we know how effective that was, because when we then came to the third seal, the black horse period, we noted the expression that a decree or a voice went out from the judiciary, the taxation voice, and it went out among the four living ones. And that gave us a clear indication that all through the empire, wherever tax went, and nobody escaped taxation, there were our brothers and sisters. So the work of the bow benders had been very, very effective indeed. So we went from white to red to civil war, and then to this awful time of injustice where famine would rage, and then we plummeted into almost the final death throes of the Roman Empire, where we saw half the empire perished with a sword, with death, with hunger, and with the beasts of the earth. And here was the pagan Roman Empire, and you could go to Rome at a given day and you would see 5,000 people having perished that day. So awful was this old, yellowy, greeny, pale, chloritic, sickly horse. And then, of course, we find ourselves with Diocletian, the last emperor of the fourth seal, who would also span over into the fifth seal, and he would be the first emperor of the fifth seal. Important to note that in these 8 years of intense persecution that reluctantly Diocletian entered into, having been goaded by his understudy Galerius, it's important to note, brothers and sisters, that Diocletian did not officially see the end of that 8 year period out as officially reigning on the throne. He abdicated, he became ill, and he stood down from the throne in 305 AD. And then the rest of that fifth seal, as our brethren cried out from the altar, "How long, O Lord, will this continue?" So we left off our study yesterday with this cry. Verse 10, Revelation chapter 6, we read these words. "And they cried with a loud voice, saying, How long, O Lord, holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth?" Now, of course, we've made a couple of mentions of this very point, whereby this word Lord, of all the times that this word is used in the Apocalypse, this is the only occasion where they use the Greek word despotes. They call God a despot, and the question is, why? I mean, we've already seen the appropriateness of God using a Machaira in the fourth seal and a Rumphaia in the second seal and a Rumphaia in the fourth seal. There's an appropriateness for God allowing himself to be addressed as a despot. And the reason for that, brothers and sisters, is this, is there was at that time when the brothers and sisters were calling a god, their god a despot, this man was on the throne, Diocletian, who was the greatest of all despots to sit upon the throne of Rome. And therefore there was this comparison or challenge. And here were the brethren and sisters challenged by who would they give their allegiance to. And they're crying to God and saying, "You are our master. No one will take your place. Despite what this man tries to do, we will not submit to his cruel despotism." And so when Diocletian came on the throne, brothers and sisters, history shows us the evidence of what this man tried to do. Rob the hearts and rob the minds of the people over which he ruled. And to show the clear despotism of this man, Diocletian, unlike Roman emperors before him, would not wear the lorette. Diocletian would wear a diadem. And Diocletian turned his palace into a city. Diocletian was not going to have any thug with a sword take him. He knew what that was like because he had been, in years gone by, a thug with a sword. Diocletian was not going to have any rich man come along and open up his wallet and buy him out. And Diocletian knew what mobs were like, so he turned his palace into a city. You could barely get to see him. And he wore a diadem, and he wore long flowing robes. And when he walked, brothers and sisters, through his palace, he walked like that, like he was gliding on ice. And people would look at him and say, "Is he Roman? He looks more like a Persian king." And that was what he wanted to show those beneath him. "I am a true sovereign despot." And you wouldn't go to him like you went to previous emperors and perhaps go down on your knee, thump your chest, look the emperor in the eye and stand back and wait to enter into dialogue. This man demanded, if you got audience with him in his palace city, he demanded that you prostrate yourself 3 times on your face before him, and when you stood up, you dared not look him in the eye. Such was the nature of this man. And so, brothers and sisters, out there in the marketplaces, at the stalls, out there in the provinces, in the villages, the hubbub was this. Who is the true despot? The Lord God, holy and true, or Diocletian unholy and untrue. And our brothers and sisters were desperately fighting to remain faithful with all of the trials that this man endeavoured to bring on him. And so how appropriate. Our brothers and sisters were saying to Almighty God, no one will rob us. No one or no thing will rob us of our true allegiance to you. What an incredible exhortation. With all the grief and the trial that that man bore, there were our brothers and sisters determined to remain faithful to the true despot in comparison to this one who claimed to be the greatest that ever lived. Well, brothers and sisters, they cried, how long? And that answer would come in measure. God was soon going to answer their cry, and he was soon going to say to the brothers and sisters, his sons and daughters, you don't have to wait long, you don't have to wait long. Very soon there's going to be an alleviation of this cruelty, and there will come relief. But it would be in measure. The greatest, of course, relief would come at the end time. So brothers and sisters, now we see the fulfillment of the words, or the answer to the cry, how long, O Lord, holy and true, would this happen? Now, this would come, of course, in the sixth seal. Now, we've got a bit of history to go through, and we'll try to keep it, and I'm, again, acutely aware of the diversity of the audience. Some have tracked through some of these things many times, so you can check out for, not 50 seconds, just check out for the, I don't know, 10 minutes if you want to. But others who have not been down this track, I need to not fly through it, otherwise our heads will be spinning a little. So we'll pace it reasonably well and therefore try to encompass pretty much all of the audience. Now what I'd like to do, brethren and sisters, first of all, just to set the scene, I'd just like to show you a little film clip. It goes for about 7 minutes, and it will set the scene. It will take us into the latter part of the fourth seal. Very briefly track us through a couple of things that happened in the fifth seal, and then take us to, well, we'll touch upon the opening, if you like, of the sixth seal. Now, what you will notice as this little clip goes through, you'll notice that that on the screen there will pop up some dates, or dates down here, and evidence of which of those seals that we're in. While we're going through this, make note of this also. There are at least, you know what happens with documentaries, depends who put them together, but there are at least three outrageous things, evidently outrageous things that are said in this film. See if you can pick them. We'll see about that in a moment. Alrighty, and this will set the scene, and then we will use this film as a springboard to see how the prayers of the saints were answered, to see what would happen when they would receive relief, and then we'll then enter into the latter part of Revelation 6 and then springboard into Revelation 12. Alrighty, now our technical crew have gone to great diligence to make sure this works, and all I have to do, I believe, is to press a couple of buttons. So we'll do that right now.
In the first years of the 3rd century, the Roman Empire is in a state of chaos. Political crises, barbarian invasions, and drastic economic troubles nearly bring about the collapse of the Roman Empire. Political infighting becomes deadly. There have been 22 emperors in 50 years, and 20 of them have died violently. In 285 AD, the Emperor Diocletian takes command and reorganizes the entire empire on a military basis. He splits the sprawling empire into eastern and western halves in an attempt to prevent his rivals from rising against him. The division of the empire seems to create more problems than it solves.
Diocletian set up what's called the Tetrarchy. There were now going to be two emperors, a Western emperor and an Eastern emperor. They'd be called Augustus or Augusti. Each of them would have under them an heir apparent called the Caesar. So you had two and two. Now you can imagine the possibilities for conflict. The Augusti could go for one another, or the Caesar could go for the Augustus. So the Tetrarchy was a very dangerous, unstable situation.
On the religious front, Diocletian creates another equally dangerous situation by renewing the vigorous persecution of Christians. In 312 AD, the unstable power structure of the divided empire collapses. Constantine, a former soldier, is named Caesar of the West. He is assigned to the furthest reach of the empire, the English city of York. It is from here that Constantine makes his fateful bid for power. With his legions, he marches south across the European continent, intent on overthrowing the emperor. 8 miles outside Rome, at the Milvian Bridge, Constantine pauses. It is the eve of what will be the greatest battle of his life, the fight for control of the empire. It is precisely at this point that the would-be emperor has a vision. It is an apparition that will change Constantine's life and the life of all Europe for the next 1700 years. Looking up in the sky, Constantine sees the sign of the cross on the face of the sun. Up until this time, Constantine has been a traditional pagan, worshiping the gods of Rome. Now he is confronted with the miraculous symbol of the forbidden Christian religion. At the same time, he hears an awesome voice announce his destiny.
And then he hears the voice say to him, "You are to conquer in this sign." And so he realizes that it's through Christ that he's going to win this battle. The battle is completely successful. They beat the opponent. He is established as the sole emperor of the western part of the empire. And ever after that, he's a Christian.
And so it was that the tiny sect of a Jerusalem rebel conquers the Roman Empire. The conversion of Constantine is one of the most important turning points in Christian history. Constantine immediately rewards his newly embraced religion by issuing the Edict of Milan, declaring official tolerance for Christianity throughout the empire. The Roman persecutions are over forever. In 323 AD, Constantine marches against the Eastern Augustus, the pagan Licinius, and defeats him after 2 years of war. Constantine is now the sole ruler of both East and West.
Well, can anyone pick one of the outright... No second thoughts about who put that together. What was one of the outrageous statements? Had to be a Catholic to put that together, didn't they? Oh, the Roman persecutions intensify. Deary me, talk about history and destroying history. Yes, they did. It split into two, but of course, remember, they had an Augusti that side and a junior Caesar, and then they had an Augusti that side and a junior Caesar. So you did have four, even though the empire was east and west. But very good. Wait, was that a Christian? He was a pagan. He saw this sign on the sun. All he was concerned about was the sun, not the sign that he saw, even though he marched into battle with that sign. Don't they flavour this man the wrong way? Make him chocolate instead of vanilla. don't they? Unbelievable. I mean, you know, and look, the sect called the Christians, they would now rule supreme over the empire. So look, but it does set the scene, brothers and sisters. It does show, doesn't it, that from an historical point of view, the greatness of this man and what this man achieved and how important it was in history, dramatically important. But we do have to be careful, of course, if we pick up documentaries, particularly with a Catholic flavour, that we make sure we sift through it. I think the thing that we need to be impressed with, of course, is yes, there was an edict of Milan that was issued in 313 AD, and this, brothers and sisters, was in measure an answer to that question, how long? Greater, of course, would that be fulfilled in time to come. Now, what I want to do also is just to put a couple of things on the whiteboard, leave them up there for today's class and tomorrow's session, and we'll refer back to these just to give us, those of us who are not particularly familiar with some of the detail of this period, and this will assist us then to launch into the last six verses of chapter 6 and, of course, chapter 12. Now, brothers and sisters, Diocletian, we said he stood down in 305, and originally there were six emperors ruling over the pagan Roman Empire. We do have, of course, over in the far west, the Augustus Constantius, who in fact was the father to Constantine. We then had the emperor Maxentius, who ended up in Rome. Now, Constantius was pro-Christian, favourably disposed to the Christians. Maxentius in Rome eventually was an absolute hater of the Christians and pagan through and through. Now, they were west in the empire. Now, over in the east, we had Licinius who emerged, who was the brother-in-law to Constantine. Licinius originally was, in fact, favourably disposed to the Christians, but he's going to turn a little later on. Also over in the east, we have an emperor, Maximin, who absolutely hates the Christians and is pagan through and through. And of course, also at one stage over in the east, we have Galerius, who was the Augusti originally over there, and he was the one that originally goaded a Diocletian into get rid of the Christians, and so Galerius was over there. So you had five at one stage, brothers and sisters. Now Galerius, who was an absolute hater of the Christians and a pagan through and through, over in the east, Galerius wanted to do Constantius in. He wanted him gone. Galerius wanted to put somebody else in power who was not favourably disposed to the Christians. But Galerius didn't get his way because Constantius died before Galerius had the opportunity to do him in. And when, of course, Constantius died, the men in the army put Constantine in place, which really upset Galerius. He didn't get his way. And so Galerius was now determined to do Constantius's son in, Constantine. But Galerius didn't get his way because Galerius died before he could fulfil that. Then as the film outworked and showed us, Constantine knew he was in trouble, not with Galerius because he's gone, but Maxentius would take the throes of Galerius, and Maxentius in Rome was going to get Constantine. Well, before he did, Constantine marched with celerity with his army, and of course the battle at Milvian Bridge, Constantine overthrew Maxentius in Rome. Now, brothers and sisters, why is this history relatively important? Well, because of this. The angels were at work removing a surplus of emperors ready for the time when there wouldn't be six, there wouldn't be five, there wouldn't be four, there would be three. Because when we come to Revelation 12, we read expressions like the pagan dragon with his tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven. And therefore, we've now got the scene set. Maxentius is gone. Constantine is now ruling in Rome in 312 over the west. And we've still got Licinius in the east. And we've got Maximin in the east. Now the scene is set to enter into Revelation chapter 12. Maximin is a pagan through and through. Licinius, well, reasonably favorably disposed, and of course Constantine would be the champion of the Christians. Now, we'll just leave that up there for now. That'll stay there for tomorrow, and from time to time we'll refer to that when we have a look at some of the detail in Revelation chapter 12. Alrighty, now here we are, sixth seal, and we're starting the sixth seal, brothers and sisters, 312, and this would last for 12 years, and in 324 there would be the great earthquake, and paganism would be finally cast out. Now, Revelation 6, very briefly, just an overview first up. Verse 12, we read these words. And I beheld when he had opened the sixth seal, and lo, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth. Oh, there's mourning going to happen now. Here is the sun of pagan Rome, and people are going to mourn its demise. Sackcloth is going to play a major part in this part of history. So the sun became black as sackcloth of hair. The moon became as blood, so something's going to happen to the pagan religion. And the stars of heaven fell to the earth, even as winter figs, when she is shaken of a mighty wind. And then we read in verse 14, the heaven departed as a scroll when it is rolled together, and every mountain and every island were moved out of their places. If you lived in pagan Rome and you thought you were secure like a mountain, you had something else coming. If you thought you lived in pagan Rome and you were remote like an island, you had something else coming, because nothing remote, nothing solid would ever, ever remain unscathed with respect to this great shaking of the people. Now, some of you may not necessarily have these quotations. I'll just put them there if you're taking notes. We're not going to turn them up. We're not talking, of course, about a literal earthquake. We're talking about a great people shake, a political earthquake. Deuteronomy 32, verse 1, bears that out very nicely. And what we recommend that you do is read the last few verses of Deuteronomy chapter 31 and then go into Deuteronomy 32, verse 1 to get the context. We know, many of us, Isaiah 1 and verses 2 and verse 10 to justify that earthquakes are political, or we're talking about the earth, I should say, with respect to people. But brothers and sisters, with respect to this earthquake in the sixth seal, it's great. And we know, I think most of us, there are how many great earthquakes in the apocalypse? There are. How many? There are three great earthquakes. There are two other occasions in the apocalypse where the word earthquake is used. We've got to be careful, because one of those two other occasions is actually attached to one of the great earthquakes, and the other occasion is a mini earthquake, which we might just briefly explore. So we've got these three great earthquakes, and when we have a look at this chart, which we've looked at a few times, we can see that God has strategically, systematically placed these three great earthquakes at the end of each of the six. So the first great earthquake is at the end of the sixth seal, the removal of paganism. The second great earthquake of chapter 11 is at the end of the sixth trumpet, the removal of the aristocracy and the Catholic hierarchy. And our third great earthquake, of course, is the greatest of all great earthquakes, which will remove the kingdom of men and bring in the kingdom of God, that 40-year period whereby, or particularly the hour of the judgment, where the world is swept aside and the Lord Jesus Christ and the saints will reign with the beginning of the millennium. Now, brothers and sisters, let's just note, those three are quite okay, but let's just note Revelation 11 for a minute, because there's another earthquake that pops up. Just to make sure we're clear, for those of us who have not necessarily spend any time here. So the three, chapter 6, chapter 11, and chapter 16, are our three great political earthquakes. But the word earthquake appears twice in chapter 11. Now, of course, we mentioned a couple of studies ago in verse 13 that in the same hour there was a great earthquake. That's the second of the great ones, the French Revolution. Well, that's okay. But then, you know, brothers and sisters, you come to the beginning of verse 14. And in verse 14 it says, the second woe is past, and behold, the third woe cometh quickly. Now, what that's saying there, the second woe. Now, look at the chart. We've got trumpet 5, trumpet 6, and trumpet 7. These are the three woe trumpets. Woe trumpet 1, woe trumpet 2, and woe trumpet 3. Now, there in Revelation chapter 11 and verse 14, the second woe is past. So the sixth trumpet is finished. Behold, the third woe cometh quickly. Now, of course, we are now introduced to the period of the vials. That would be the third woe. That would be the blasting of the, or the beginning of the blasting of the seventh trumpet. Now, here's a tricky thing. If you were reading and you wanted to follow the chronology of the story, and you were reading verse 14, and it says, all right, the sixth trumpet is past, and behold, the seventh trumpet cometh quickly. If you want to follow the chronology, you need to turn over, brothers and sisters, to Revelation 16 and continue the story. And what you get at the end of chapter 11 after that statement where it says the second woe is past and behold the third woe cometh quickly, catapulting us into chapter 16 to follow the detail of the chronology, but what you do get in Revelation 11 is you get verses 15 through 19, which gives us an overview of the third woe or an overview of the seventh trumpet, the detail of which, of course, begins in chapter 16. Therefore, because verse 15 through 19 is this overview, the detail of which would be picked up in chapter 16, which has the third great earthquake, therefore when you read in verse 19 of chapter 11, it says, and the temple of God was opened in heaven. There are the saints reigning in Jerusalem, our Lord Jesus Christ there, and there was seen in the saints the glory of God. And then we read there that that there were lightnings and voices and thunderings and an earthquake. And an earthquake. Well, what you need to make a note of, if you're not aware of this, is that that earthquake, although not called a great earthquake, is the very earthquake that is mentioned as great in chapter 16. So if you're taking notes, you make a little cross-reference and say that earthquake is referenced in summary here to the great earthquake of Revelation chapter 16. That tidies that one up. Now, the other occasion where this is found, and I'll pop that on the screen for you, we've tidied up Revelation 11 and verse 19. The only other occasion that we then find the mention of the word earthquake in the apocalypse is, in fact, Revelation 8 and verse 5. So just flick across there with me. Now, what I want to do is just establish a couple of facts about this verse, and we're going to certainly embellish our material when we come to deal with the trumpets in our last two studies together. But I want to just clear this one up so we've dealt with all the earthquakes and we don't stumble over this perhaps when we're reading through it. Verse 5, Revelation 8. And the angel took the censer and filled it with fire of the altar and cast it to the earth. Now be very careful, because in the last little sentence of verse 5 are two time dates. So we read there that this casting to the earth, in answer to the prayers of the saints, we read there were voices, thunderings and lightnings. Brothers and sisters, when Constantine came in 312 and took Rome, emperor of the West, he then, 12 years later, beat his brother-in-law Licinius, and in 324 he took the East, and in 324 the great earthquake, and Constantine is now ruler of the world in 324. And from 324 until the time that Constantine died, there was absolute tranquility, silence in heaven. Revelation 8 verse 1. Silence. So as soon as Constantine is the ruler of the world, there's silence until he dies. And when Constantine died in 337, which we'll pick up later, there was all this chaos come back again. Therefore, when you read Revelation 8 and verse 5, when it says there were voices and thunderings and lightnings, this is the death of Constantine, 337 AD. But I'm going to prove that and go through that in more detail later. But just note 337. The tricky bit is after Constantine dies in 337, there's all of these thunderings and voices and lightnings. There's all this bickering and contention between Constantine's three sons as they're carving up the empire. There's all this bickering and contention between the bishops in Alexandria and the bishops in Antioch and the bishops in Constantinople. Who's Jesus? Is he God or is he a man? There's religious turmoil, there's political turmoil, there's thunderings and lightnings. Well, guess what? There was a fellow that comes on the scene some years later and says, you call this Christianity? You call this stability? I'm getting rid of Christianity. And in he comes, and his name's Julian, and he's the nephew to Constantine. And he comes in 361 AD, and he says, that's it. Paganism's back for 2 years. So when you read here, it says there was an earthquake after all this infighting between Constantine's sons and all the religious nuts over in the eastern side. Well, brothers and sisters, when it says there was an earthquake, that's 361 AD when Julian brings in paganism for 2 years. It's not a great earthquake, it's a little quake because it's only going to last a small pocket of time. I was a bit rushed, a bit quick, but if you've got a couple of dates and a couple of notes down there and you're a bit perplexed by that, don't be, because well, maybe you weren't with us, maybe you'd gone for 50 seconds. We're going to deal with that in more detail, God willing, tomorrow, and then, of course, in the trumpet period. Alrighty. Now, an overview, a very quick synopsis or overview of the sixth seal before we then go into Revelation 12. So we've got this great earthquake, the first great earthquake, the political upheaval, of course, in the pagan Roman world, and then we've got the sun eclipsed, which is the end of the pagan emperors, they being gods, the greater light in the heavens. We've got our stars falling from heaven. This is the administration of the pagan Roman Empire. And then, of course, we've got the moon that becomes blood. So we've now got the death of the pagan religion, which would be replaced by the Catholic religion. And brothers and sisters, we made the comment that that overview in Revelation 6, the last six verses, for detail, we need to go to Revelation 12. I just want to consider for a couple of minutes one of the warrants or justifications of jumping into 12 as a more detailed exposition of those last six verses. Look at the similarities that appear in the six verses of Revelation 6 and all of chapter 12. Now, what we've got in verse 12 of Revelation 6 is the expression, a great earthquake. Its counterpart, of course, in detail in verse 7 of chapter 12, is that paganism would be cast out. That's the great earthquake. The dragon, the great red dragon. And we've got this expression, Michael, he like God, who would be Constantine, and we'll prove that when we come to that, God willing, tomorrow. Another expression we have in chapter 6 that has its counterpart in chapter 12 is that in verse 13 we have the stars of heaven fell to the earth, where in verse 4 of chapter 12 we have the pagan dragon drawing the third part of the stars of heaven. So you see the expression, the stars are falling there, and the stars fall in Revelation 12. We then have in verse 12 of Revelation 6, the sun is blackened, moon turns to blood. Well, we've got a sun in Revelation 12 and we've got a moon in Revelation 12. So that theme certainly carries through into that chapter. And then lastly, an interesting comparison, and again we'll pick this up, God willing, tomorrow, is in verse 16. We hear all these people yelling and screaming and saying, as a result of this great upheaval in the pagan world, where Christianity comes in and Constantine marching into battle, there's all these people screaming in verse 16 saying, fall on us and hide us from the face of him that sitteth upon the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. And then in verse 10 and 11 of chapter 12 we read, and they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb. So there are lots of warrants and justifications to show at least there must be some connecting link between chapter 6 and chapter 12. Now, here's a question. Probably a good time to ask a question, actually, because you've had two studies and a bit, two studies and a half so far. You must be really taxed at the moment. You taxed? You going all right? Nobody's drifted off? Okay. Here's a question. Why, brothers and sisters, do we do a great big leap right across to chapter 12 to get this detail? I want to show you something. You may or may not have seen this before. I hope you follow me. I want to just flick back to Revelation 11 and show you something as to why Revelation 12 appears way, way, way up there, and why doesn't it just get linked to chapter 6? Why doesn't it just follow the theme, you see? Now, when you come to chapter 11, so you go to chapter 6, you get the history. You go to chapter 8, you get the continual history of the next phase with the barbarians. And you go to chapter 9 and you get the next part of the history, and there's an interruption in chapter 10. Then you go to chapter 11 and you get the next part of the history. So there's this chronological flow of history to chapter 11. Now, the key is in chapter 11, you see, as to why chapter 12 pops up where it does. And it gives us an understanding of why it's way up there and not next to chapter 6 itself. You come to chapter 11. Now, watch this. Verse 7. We don't need to know the context, just this word. And when they had finished their testimony, the witnesses, the beast that ascended out of the abyss made war against them and overcame them. Now, this is the first time, brothers and sisters, in the apocalypse where John is introduced to the beast. He's seen horses in chapter 6. He's seen locusts. He's seen barbarians that have given these different titles. He's seen cannons in chapter 9. He's seen a whole raft of things, brothers and sisters, but he hasn't seen the beast. And when he gets to chapter 11 and verse 7, there's this beast that rises out and does something. And John's probably looking there thinking, well, I haven't seen this before. And God says, really, in the record, John, you need to get your head around what this beast is so you really do understand the context of what's happening here in Europe in 1572 in Revelation 11. Let's go back a step now, having introduced you for the first time to the beast, and I'll show you about its progression. So God goes back in time. We're introduced to chapter 12, the pagan dragon. That's where it started, John. And then in chapter 13 of Revelation, it then morphs into the sea beast. And then in Revelation 13, it morphs into the earth beast. And then in Revelation 13, we've got the image of the beast. And then in Revelation 17, down the track, we've got the scarlet-coloured beast. So after John, particularly looking at the great red dragon, then looking at the sea beast, then looking at the earth beast, and then looking at the image of the beast, he gets to the end of chapter 13, and he's a little bit beasted out, let me tell you. He's seen all of these beasts, and he thinks, oh, now I've got it. Now I really do now appreciate when I see the beast in chapter 11, because I've now been stepped back in time. The problem is when he gets to the end of chapter 13, John's thinking, this beast is so powerful, it's nothing's going to overcome it. Nothing. It's going to stand forever. It's just too powerful. And God says, well, let's just now introduce you to chapter 14, just to lift you up. And the first verse you read in chapter 14 is about another beast, but it's a little lamb. And in chapter 14, this little lamb overcomes this ferocious beast manifested in chapter 12 and chapter 13. That's how it works, you see, brothers and sisters. So that's why we have to wait till we get to chapter 12, because it's just coupled next to chapter 11 to give John that embellishment, if you like, of the first time that he sees the beast. There are other reasons, but that, look, I think is quite a neat little explanation, I hope, to you as to why Revelation 12 pops there. Alrighty. Now, brothers and sisters, Revelation 12. We're not going to go to our full-time slot. I'm looking at the clock and see it really well. You can have a look if you want to. All right, you don't have to do it surreptitiously. I won't bother me if you keep looking at the clock. 1 minute to 12 for those who want a declaration of what time it is. All right, now let's very, very quickly have a look at some key factors out of Revelation 12, which gives us the detail of what is mentioned in the sixth seal in Revelation 6, the last six verses. Now, you and I, many here in this room, know that with respect to Revelation 12, brothers and sisters, the real center stage, or one of the clear center stages of Revelation 12, is that verse there, verse 7. And there was war in heaven. This is a political, this is a war in the political heavens. This, brothers and sisters, is going to be a war for Rome. So immediately, center stage in chapter 12, there's going to be a battle for Rome. It wasn't just one battle. There were a series of battles over 12 years before finally the whole world was wrested from paganism and then became Christian. So we read, therefore, in verses 7 through 9, there was war in heaven. Constantine and his army, these are the fellow servants that we spoke about in the fifth seal. Ah, the fellow servants now have got their champion. There he is there. So the fellow servants of the brethren are there. So there was war in heaven. Constantine and his army fought against, in this instance, and we'll see this tomorrow, fought against Licinius, brother-in-law, the pagan dragon, because he changed his spots. And the dragon, Licinius, fought against Constantine with his army, and the great red dragon, in this instance, Licinius, was cast out, that old serpent. Now, brothers and sisters, there's the pagan dragon. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to pop in the mouth of that pagan dragon three pagan emperors. You're going to see how this outworks tomorrow. I'm going to pop Galerius in the mouth. There's Galerius up there. He plays a little part in this. I'm going to pop Maxentius in his mouth, and there's Maxentius there. He certainly played a part. And Licinius there, he certainly plays a part in these battles. Now, this is a really neat thing to do if you haven't done it. Some of you may have. I really recommend that you colour in these sections here that I've got coloured in red. For those of you younger ones, perhaps, who haven't coloured in this in red, be very careful and only colour those bits in, because in a moment you're going to see the dragon appear again toward the end of chapter 12 and also pop up in chapter 13. But the dragon that appears toward the end of chapter 12 and pops in chapter 13 is the different dragon. It's a Christian dragon, you see. So if you colour all those in, I don't know whether you can see that on the notes that you've got, but if you colour all that in, that is particularly and peculiarly pagan Rome. The Christian dragon is going to come in a moment. All right, brothers and sisters, a question. I mean, this is ho-hum, not ho-hum, sorry, bad terms, forgive me for that. This is old ground for many of us to say that pagan Rome is the dragon or the great red dragon. May I ask you a question? How would you go about proving that this great red dragon with seven heads and ten horns is Rome? If you were face to face with an interested friend, or perhaps another brother or sister that was not familiar, or maybe worse, a brother and sister that was perhaps a little antagonistic about the continuous historical interpretation, where would you go? Where does your mind go to logically and clearly establish that this great red dragon with seven heads and ten horns is Rome? Where would you go? Daniel 7 is a good starting point. And I hear where you're coming from, James. Daniel 7 is very good. Daniel 7 gives us some ideas about its development, but you would need to do a bit of explanation to an interested friend to actually pinpoint the seven heads. Daniel 7 shows you a beast, the fourth beast, with one head, upon which there are horns. But I hear where you're coming from. There's a clearer chapter that you could go to that really does, I think, very well establish that this is talking about pagan Rome. Any other chapter? The Bible? Revelation? Excellent. I would go to Revelation 17, brothers and sisters. I think Revelation 7, coupled with Daniel 7, yes, but I think Revelation 17 is very good. And for a minute or two, I just want to show you this. The first bit is simple, oh so simple. The next bit is a little challenging, almost like a quadratic equation in math. Now, Revelation 17, we're introduced to those verses where we read of a scarlet-coloured beast. The identifying factor, of course, is seven heads, as there was in Revelation 12. The other identifying factor in Revelation 17, 10 horns, as there was in Revelation 12. So we've got a dragon, we've got a scarlet-coloured beast, seven heads, 10 horns. It's pretty clear that this is a related monster. This is a related beast. Therefore, in Revelation 17, in verse 9, we are given a geographic identification to this woman and the beast. And we're told that the seven heads represent seven mountains. Well, how many of us have seen this diagram? Here we've got, showing the political identification, here we have, brothers and sisters, a coin that was minted in 71 AD during the reign of Vespasian. And the coin, of course, and its symbology would have been very familiar to the first century ecclesia, and it depicts Roma as a woman sitting among seven hills. Well, that's okay. The next bit is the tricky bit, because when you come to the next bit, you see, and there are seven forms of government. So not only do we have a geographic identification, we have a political identification, just to cement the fact that we know where we stand. Now, when we come to this, of course, we're told in Revelation 17 that five of these forms of government have fallen. One is, and one is yet to come. That's the simple bit. Let's just look at that. John, you want to know who this creature is? Well, this creature has got seven forms of government attached to them. John, there are five forms of government that have already existed in pagan Rome. We have got the regal. 700 BC, Rome was a monarchy. They had a king. So there's the regal form of government. And then in 500 BC, Rome became a republic. And in that republican period, there were four forms of government that were used over the republic. So the next form of government that came in was the consular form of government. And there were two consuls that ruled over Rome. All the Senate was there in an advisory capacity with legislative matters, and people had their say, but two consuls ruled over Rome. The problem was, brothers and sisters, during this consular rulership, there was a division among the people. And there were this group of people and another group of people that started to conflict with one another. One group of people were called the plebeians. Do you have that expression in Canada, you're a pleb? Do you have that expression? You don't use that. In Australia, we do. I remember working in the workforce, and very often there would be people sitting in the office, I'm just a pleb around here. Now, the word plebeian is a commoner or a common person, so they picked up that word from ancient Rome, and they attribute that to themselves. I'm just one of the plebs, I'm not a person in charge here. So you've got in the consular period of Rome the plebeians, and then you've got the patricians. They were the upper crust of society, both at each other's throats during this consular period. Well, from time to time, when there were issues internally and on the border of Rome, they would bring in a dictator to sort it out temporarily. So Rome was ruled over in a dictatorial format. So we've got a regal, a consular, and a dictatorial format. Well, the dictator didn't do too good because the plebeians and the patricians were still at each other's throat. So they're scratching their head thinking, what are we going to do? I know, let's go to Greece. Let's send 10 men across there. Let's have a look at the laws in Greece. Let's see if we can rewrite some Roman laws. So 10 men come back, deci. So we've now got the decemviral. They brought them back. They put them originally on 10 tables. They then became 12 down the track. But we've got decemviral, the rule of 10. Well, the plebeians and the patricians were still at each other's throat, couldn't sort it out. And finally, the plebeians started to push their representatives, which were called tribunes. So we have the tribunicial form of government. John, five have existed. Regal, consular, dictatorial, decemviral, tribunicial. Ah, but one is. So there's John there, brothers and sisters. One is. So in the time of AD 96, when John received this, the ruling power in the time of John was the imperial. Emperors ruled. And then the record says the other is not yet come. So there was another form of rulership in Rome that had not yet come. Now that's the easy bit. The tricky bit is this. When you read on in Revelation 17, five are fallen, one is yet to come. Then it goes on and says, and when he comes, he must continue a short space. So when this one eventually came after the imperial form of government, he would continue a short space. Well, many of us know this was the Goths, which we'll pick up in our fourth wind trumpet. So the Goths came in as barbarians, but they had a heart of Rome. They loved the Roman ways, and the Goths came in and ruled in Rome. Barbarians they were, but they loved the Roman regalia. And they would rule for a short space, and they would rule for 60 years. That's the easy bit. Five are fallen, one is, that's where you are, John, one is yet to come, the Goths. When they come, they'll continue a short space. Here's the tricky bit. And the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth and is of the seven and goeth into perdition. What does that mean? Now, to understand that, brothers and sisters, very simply, all you've got to do is do this. The beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth and is of the seven and goeth into perdition. What you've got to do is this. One is yet to come, the Goths. When they come, they must continue a short space. Now let's go to when they have come and put John into the future. When they come, they must continue a short space. John, stand there. Stand with the Goths. Now look back. The one that was and is not, because I'm there now, even he is the eighth and is one of the seven. How simple is that? So John's got to stand there, look back, and when you read that verse, here I am with the Goths in the future, when they would continue a short space, look back, the ruling power that was is not now, but it's coming back. And when the Goths were kicked out, brothers and sisters, many, many, many years later, the imperial system of rulership would shine again through the likes of the Holy Roman Empire. How'd you go? You, was that okay? You follow that? Glad you did. Okay. Rightio, in summary, I think you've got it in summary on your notes, but look at it, it's marvellous, brothers. When we can understand verses like that, and they do really mean something to us, there they are, five are fallen, one is yet to come. All righty, let's go with John over there. Stand there with the Goths, look back, the one that was and is not, because I'm right there, even he is the eighth, and is up, bringing back one of the seven that existed in the past. And if you want a little quotation, it's great to couple that up with Revelation 13 and verse 3, because in Revelation 13 verse 3 it simply says, and one of the heads, one of the seven heads, was wounded to death. And his deadly wound was healed. So when it says in Revelation 13, verse 3, that one of the seven heads was wounded to death, well, there is the wound. There's one of the seven heads wounded to death. And then his deadly wound was healed there. What a wonderful thing it is to look at those verses and bring those verses together. Well, brothers and sisters, I think we might leave it there and pick this up, God willing, tomorrow, because tomorrow we're going to get you to say, ah, now there's the pagan red dragon. We're now going to see the dragon change. Now look at this. We're going to have a blue dragon. Well, I've got a blue dragon, you may not. But you're now going to see why it's important to colour that in, because the man-child, Michael, becomes in the first instance the serpent, the dragon. Constantine in the first instance, his sons thereafter, and those rulers would eventually rule as Christian emperors from Constantinople. So we'll just pick that up tomorrow. And God willing, our title tomorrow, brothers and sisters, as we look through Revelation 12 particularly, will be, "And the woman fled into the wilderness." Thank you very much.